Thanks very much, Eric. Good morning, and you're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, who owns Ireland and for what? Is land becoming too expensive to produce food on? An army of citizen scientists joins the fight to restore water quality, and we are spinning yarns in Galway. Good morning. I hope you are well. I hope you are one of the lucky ones now at the right end of a long weekend ahead of you. We are going to start this morning by taking a look at land prices, how they might be shaping the look and the feel and the function of the country. We're going to hear from a number of different voices, some saying that land prices are so high that they're pushing farmers off the land. Others, this is nothing new, that farmers have been buying land that they can't afford for as long as there has been land. I want to start with a visit to a farm that may, before too long, not be a dairy farm anymore. Donal Sheehan is a voice that will be known to many countrywide listeners from the Bride Project in North Cork. Donal rents half of his farm, and when that half was put on the market recently, he was unable to afford to buy it. You have a nice mix of grasses going on here, and only a few docks for somebody who's gone organic.
That'll improve. Would you believe it? No, this was a multi-species sward when we planted it back in 2016.
Uh-huh.
It was one of the first, I'd say, because it was John Finn. I knew John Finn.
Down the years, Donal has worked very hard to transform his dairy farm to a little pocket of biodiverse richness. The final step was going organic. And by last year, he'd have been forgiven for thinking that he had got it all figured out.
It was a very easy way of farming in that... The cow numbers matched what I was trying to achieve, even from an environmental point of view. Like in 2017, our nitrogen usage was 37 ton. We brought that down into 20 ton in 2020. Last year we used a half a ton, and this year then I converted to transitioned over to organic because I was nearly there anyway. Like the nitrogen and the pesticides was never a problem because we don't use them anyway. I dropped cow numbers from 75 to 65. To make sure I wasn't going to run out of grass.
So by 2023, you must have felt like you were sitting pretty. The right number of cows, yeah. Virtually nil fertiliser yeah. usage.
Yeah, so we were ticking all the right environmental boxes, as it were. We were after reducing our carbon footprint because we had reduced cow numbers. Our methane emissions were down because we had gone from 75 cows down to 65. Our nitrous oxide emissions were completely gone because we had no more chemical nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And we were... regeneratively farming because all our slurry now was replacing the chemical nitrogen. So
tick, 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 tick all the way down the list. But then, as they say, when men make plans, the gods smile.
It was always very precarious because when you rent ground, you don't own it. The land came up for sale and... we were able to put in a bid of 18,000 an acre. That's
18,000.
Yeah,
and you 18,000.
Yeah, and you have to remember, Philip, that there's no return of investment on 18,000 an acre. This is what you do. I mean, myself and my wife, you know, we cobbled together what we could. We went to the bank, and that's what we came up with, 18,000 an acre.
But there was somebody with deeper pockets.
Yeah, and this is the law of the jungle. Even at 18,000 an acre, I would have been 75 years by the time I would have it paid off. So it would be landed with whoever's taken over the farm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was going to the bank, pleading your case, saying, trying to give a sustainable story because that's what we're all supposed to do. And that's what they came up with. But, you know, I had gone organic. So I was after dropping my cow numbers from 75 down to 65.
And did the bank advise you to go intensive and ditch this organic
that,
nonsense?
That was because the repayment capacity is based on the number of cows you have. It's not based on your sustainability criteria going forward. And I was told that I should consider going back up to 75 cows and not going organic because ultimately your repayment capacity depends on the number of cows you have.
What happens now then? How much of your farm do you lose when you have to vacate these fields?
I'd be down to under 50 cows, you know, especially with organic. And the viability of that going forward in yeah, you just, you know.
Tell me.
Well, you know, it would be just tough to, you know, to make a living. Those farmers doing it, but in what I was trying to do here, it would just be difficult.
So, how was calving?
It was straightforward enough. So these are the last few Anguses and Herefords, and they'll go to a local beef farmer down in Lismore.
So what are your choices then? Or is there really only one? Stop farming.
That will probably won't happen, Philip, because I'm just moulded now at this stage, you know. My fulfilment is farming and dealing with animals and being out with nature, and that's what drives me. And so, you know, putting me in an office or anywhere else, it wouldn't float my boat, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, people have pivoted before, and I'll have to make the changes. These are the changes that are happening. You know, I'll have to make changes so that I can survive. I've a family, and you know, that has to come into play as well. You have to ensure that there's some income coming in, you know.
Do you have a sense of yours being yet another family that's not going to still be on the land come the next generation?
This farm it's going back to 1840 with the same family, and you know, that comes into play. You don't want to be the generation that didn't continue it on. But we are in really challenging times, and everything. What floored me is how quickly this changed. You know, I would have seen myself as being somewhat viable, although precarious, because the land was rented. But, you know, in the space of a month, I was looking at my own viability as a dairy farmer. It was frightening, you know. You just don't expect it to happen. But it did happen, and I'll have to face it. And, you know, there's other people have loads of difficulties out there, and I'm sure, you know, I'll survive. But
you have your health, you have assets to sell, absolutely. I mean, you're not on the side of the road. But at the same time, what does it do to you to be the person who broke that 180 years of tradition?
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult because it's my bread and butter, and it's my life. It's my family's life. It was what we were born, bred, and reared to do. It's what my father before me did, and that's not to say, you know, that I can't change. Of course, I can change, and you know, you do what you have to do to make a living, but. It's the kind of love of my life, you know, and it's just, I suppose, it's just hard to swallow, that's all.
As we walked back through the fields that have been sold and will presumably now be put to a different purpose, Donal points out a stone chat sitting in a corner allowed to go to scrub.
Show him to me, where is he?
Him up in the wire.
I can't see his markings from here.
Yeah, he's a black head, and then he's a white kind of a collar, and he's a red breast then, really, and his mate is always with him, the two of them are always together.
Stone chats feed on insects, and this pair presumably returned because Donald stopped using insecticides.
And they were never here before?
No.
That's a sense of achievement, now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And even that pond, you see the water hens further down and the chicks.
Oh, yeah.
They were never there before until we allowed that pond to remain.
You must feel proud of that.
Yeah, to small little things like that float my boat. I don't, you know, but maybe I should change. Maybe I should be looking at the milk dockets and more important things.
Do you really feel that?
This is, you know, it's maybe a fault of mine, like, you know, that I put such value on
on nature over business.
Yeah. Weakness in the system.
So then, is Donald Sheehan the next in a long line who will be pushed off the land by unchecked market forces, or is it wrong to draw general and drastic conclusions from one admittedly upsetting story? Brian Leonard is from a Sligo farming stock but makes a living in UCD Agriculture Department, where, among other things, he examines the economic role of the farm in rural Ireland. Daniel Long is a Tipperary farmer campaigning for state intervention in the market, as happens in some other European countries. And in the absence of a register telling us who bought what, for how much and for what purpose, land agent Michael Brady can tell us what he has seen going on in his area of operations in Munster. Good morning to all three of you gentlemen. Michael, can I start with you first, please? When farmland comes on the market now, who tends to be at the top of the queue? Is it investors or is it other farmers?
Good morning, Philip. Thank you for having me on. I suppose the first thing I would point out, Philip, is that very few, we've 140,000 farmers in the year. There are about somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 land transactions every year. So it's a very small percentage of landowners or farmers who actually buy land. So to answer your question, who actually are those 2,000 to 3,000 transactions every year? Full-time commercial farmers are top of the tree. Dairy farmers are very often touted as the ones that are buying up all the land. That's not necessarily true in all areas. Yes, dairy farming is probably more profitable than most of the other traditional enterprises. So full-time commercial dairy farmers are certainly part of that equation. Next in line would be part-time farmers with off-farm income. Okay, we heard a good story there from Donald Sheehan. He mentioned, he went to the bank and he himself and his spouse went to the bank. So I'd assume there was an off-farm income as well. So you need both to try and go buy land. Then you've cash-rich tax investors that are buying. Tax is a big driver of land for large plots of land in general. Sometimes it's maybe dying down a bit again. Over the last couple of years when interest rates were low, some business people invested in land. Then you have forestry, your forestry companies. You have developers and compulsory purchase, developers for housing. You have compulsory purchase for roads. And I suppose the last one, which is new, we have, which should be in your own scene, and we probably have an emergence of an environmental investor. The state are buying land. You know, they bought, is it Moll's Gap below in Kerry recently? So that's a new angle to
Okay. Remind us, will you please, of the tax loophole that the wealthy are using land purchases to avail of, and tell me how big a part of the picture that is.
Well, there's land and businesses are an efficient way to transfer wealth, we'll say cash, from one generation to the next. If you take somebody living in 3-bedroom Simi D in Dublin or Cork or Limerick and you want to give some cash to your children, the limit is, I think, 335,000 for capital acquisitions tax, CAT. There's a special relief called agricultural relief for farmland and for farms, and there's a relief called business relief for businesses, whereby an asset is reduced to 10% of its value for tax purposes. So a simple calculation, you can get 3.3 million's worth of land and pay no capital acquisitions tax. Okay.
And how big a part of the picture is that?
I believe, certainly for trophy properties, very large properties. You know, like in Ireland last year, I think we had 4 or 5 10 million plus properties in the country for sale. In my career, and I'm over 30 years in the business, that's the first time I've ever seen that in this country, where, you know, there were farms or land or estates and over 10 million euros. To me, tax is the driver of all those investments.
Okay, but important piece of context here is that still top of the list in any land transfer is farmers and dairy farmers at the top of that list. Let me go to Brian Leonard. UCD. Brian, in the last 40 years, we've seen 100,000 farms being amalgamated or gobbled up by other farms, basically. That's 100,000 families, maybe times four people in each family that have left the land. Do you think now that that is a process that is going to accelerate or continue at the same pace with these land prices?
Good morning, Philip. I really think the trends are showing that the acceleration that you mentioned maybe isn't going to take off. It's going to be more of the same. And as Michael mentioned there, land mobility is quite low in Ireland. Less than 1% of agricultural land at a national level actually goes on sale in the open market every year. So I don't think there's going to be acceleration. The family farm model has been dominant in Ireland and across Europe so far. Familial inheritance is the dominant way in which to get into farming. So I don't believe there's going to be a large boost in sales.
Okay, notwithstanding that though, if it is somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of land that changes hands every year, that means that by 2050, somewhere between 12.5% and 0.25% of the country could change hands and maybe change purpose.
Possibly. I don't want to enter too much speculation, I suppose, Philip. But as Michael mentioned as well, the vast majority of these buyers are farmers. And the other thing is you have to look at maybe the different parts of the country and the levels of income associated with farm systems that are dominant there. So in the south and southeast, of course, dairy and tillage are dominant. They traditionally have had higher incomes, whereas in the west where I'm sitting at the moment, you have suckler and sheep farmers where incomes are lower. So I don't necessarily see this, even if we got to our, as you mentioned, the 12% level of land mobility across so many years, the buyers are still farmers, and we have historically been buying land for more than what it is worth in terms of economic return.
Daniel, you're no stranger to pressure on land in your part of the country in Tipperary, but since starting the campaign that you've embarked on this issue, you've had farmers from all over the country say to you that they're at the sharp end of the same problem. Tell me what you've been hearing.
Well, I suppose our campaign would have started probably, maybe over 2 months ago. And it was born out of, Tipperary, where I'm from, is kind of an epicentre where you see an awful lot of consolidation and very high value for land. But I think we need to remember that, when we mention a family farm, that's currently without a definition, and we don't really have a size or a model that fits all of what we work off of. But the petition essentially was started by farmers and people from the environmental community and people from the scientific and academic community. And the idea behind it was that we would try and get as many signatures as possible from those, with the idea of mandating us to hold a meeting around the idea of setting up a land observatory, which is currently in our land use policy.
What is a land observatory and how would it work, Daniel?
So a land observatory essentially would have oversight. It would act as a watchdog, but would have oversight over land use and preserve landscape and the viability of rural communities and provide access to farmers, access to land for young farmers and generational renewal. Because we need to remember, we have a very high average age of farmers in this country, and we have a very small percentage of young farmers taking on land. And while we're saying that the farms are transferring onto other farms, like, what we don't want is a situation where an awful lot of the land is concentrated in very few of the farmers of Ireland, which is no good for. Like, we have a family farm model, and that's what we base our exports on.
Daniel, I can see why young farmers might be interested in something like that. I would imagine that older farmers would be very resistant to anybody sticking their nose into their ability to sell their land to whomever they want for the highest value that they can get.
Well, as it would, first and foremost, what we want is, we have an open market and people should be able to attain the maximum value for their property as possible. But we also need to remember that we have a community responsibility as well. And a lot of these land, when you do consolidate farms, there is a biodiversity issue, because farms that need to increase in scale may have small paddocks and hedgerows, and you see a lot of hedgerows removal, which is a feature that happens in Tipperary when you see consolidation of land. And it's multifaceted as well. And an observatory, as I said, this isn't new. France have had it since the 1960s. Scotland are currently looking at it. It could actually be a vehicle for collaboration among science, environmental groups and agriculture rather than division, which you see an awful lot in farming at the moment.
Brian, one of the interesting things that's quite often overlooked in this conversation is that the Constitution gives expression or says that the Oireachtas should do whatever it can to support the family farm in the circumstances and the best circumstances that shall be practicable, I think it says. Is what Daniel is proposing here a practical way of giving expression to that?
Yeah, but look, there are things in place at the moment as well to protect that family farm model in terms of taxation and favourable taxation to transfer within families. But what Daniel mentioned there, of course, it's definitely something that's worth monitoring. I think at the moment, based on the, as I mentioned, the low land mobility figures, maybe moving to any level of legislative or a regulation might be too early. But I would 100% agree with Daniel in terms of if we were to collect data on that and ensure that it's something that's monitored so we do avoid, you know, large-scale land consolidation. And also, I just want to maybe mention as well, Daniel mentioned kind of a lack of definition for a family farm. At a European level, a family farm is generally defined as one that's managed and operated by a household where the labour is generally supplied from within that family household. So it's a broad enough definition, but there is a general definition there.
Michael, I wonder, does viability matter to most of the people that you see in these queues to buy land when it comes on the market? Or are they thinking more in terms of legacy and standing in the community and something to pass on to the next generation?
Philip, I think like the conversation we've been having there for the past 5 minutes is very local. It's an Irish, like we're even going down to county level. Okay. If we jump up a bit higher and look at this more on a global scale, okay, the land market in Ireland is absolutely unique. To answer your question, viability is irrelevant. It's whether you can afford it or not is the question. And like the question I will get asked wearing my consultant's hat, if a farmer wants to buy land, how can I buy it? He's not asking me the return on investment. He's not asking me whether it's a good investment or a bad investment. It's like the Donal Sheehan example. Donal Sheehan could arrive into my office and say, I want to buy this land. How do I get it? Right. Okay.
And do you ever advise any of these people and say, no, that is a bad return on your investment. Go spend your money somewhere else.
My job is to put the options on the table to the client. Okay. But like, we've got a history with land in this country, and like the reason you have to look at yourself and ask the question, why is return on investment not on the table here? It's number one, because of so little land comes for sale. Sometimes you have people saving up for generations to be able to buy the bachelor farmer next door that they're waiting to pass on. So that's not, that could be in Parish A, but in Parish B, there might be three pieces of land come up for sale at the same time, which would bring down the value. So it's just not real. Like if I was in Australia recently, and if you go to Tasmania, country about the same, or an island about the same size as Ireland. Now, half it is forestry, but over 50% of the land in that country is owned by corporates. And it was interesting, I chatted to some dairy farmers there, and they were actually in favour of the corporates buying, because they said that the farmers themselves would not have the capital to develop the farms. Like you had an excellent conversation with Donal Sheehan there, and Donal was doing his figures, adding up every last penny. He said he could go 17,000 or 18,000 an acre on the land, and I think it made 26 or 7,000 an acre, right? But if he did buy that, he would have had no money to invest in that land over the next 10 or 15 years. Whereas the argument that was made to me for Tasmania was a corporate pension fund, whatever, come in, they buy 1,000 hectares, they develop the farm. But the thing that people don't realise, they create a lot of jobs as well, okay? So the Donal Sheehan could go in and run the dairy farm on that and maybe make even more money and still have his own farm.
But it is still about attachment and legacy and all of those things.
In this country it is. Yeah. In this country it is. So it's not about return investment. It's about a row of 40 medals on the chest.
Where Bull McCabe killed the American, his modern day equivalent goes and takes out a multi-generational mortgage. Michael Brady, thank you very much. And Daniel Long and Brian Leonard. Let's take a break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Let me clarify that although land is going for 26, 27 grand an acre in some cases, that was not actually what the sale price on that land in Cork actually went for at the end of the day. For as long as she can remember, Hannah Quinn Mulligan knows that her grandmother Catherine has had Hereford beef animals on their farm. But in the last 18 months, they have moved into milking on a small scale, and that has brought new breeds of cows into the yard. This week, they prepared their Jersey maiden heifers to be put into calf. But despite all the decades of experience between Hannah and her grandmother, these young animals were giving them the runaround.
Sprinkle some feed out, they'll stick their heads out, and then they'll stand still, hopefully, when I put the scratch guards on. Good girls. Did you ever think you'd have Jersey heifers on the farm, Granny?
I did not, no. I didn't even think I'd have dairy calves, to be honest.
These scratch cards are so sticky. Will you hold them here? I feel like a beautician. I feel like I've got wax strips or something like that. Do you see how sticky the scratch cards are? And then basically what you're meant to do is you sort of put them just on the rump of their tail, a little bit higher than the rump of their tail. Do you see how sticky that is? Look at the glue.
Yeah.
And when the heifer's in heat, she stands still for another heifer to jump on top of her. If she'd stand still for me to put the scratch guard on in the first place, I should have put them in the crush. And so when the heifer's in heat, she stands still and another heifer jumps on top of her. And obviously, it's called bulling, but the scratch guard, it changes colour. So it's grey at the minute and then it turns pink. Pink to make the boys wink, isn't that right? Little Jersey heifer coming up, giving me a lick. She's not really coming for a lick. Do you know what she's coming for? Treats. She managed to open my pocket the other day. She unzipped my pocket and found dog treats in there. And ever since then, she's been obsessed with trying to do it again. Oh my God, they're so sticky. Good girl. And this is... Good girl. This is the second time I've put these scratch cards on. Because the first time I put them on, do you know what happened?
What happened?
They licked them off each other.
Oh my goodness.
And I know I'm not doing it wrong because I put scratch cards in all the Frisians and they're still on. They haven't been up to hijinks and shenanigans like you lot have.
Have you decided what to inseminate them with, Hannah?
I have, because they're pure Jersey, I have sex semen's drawers ordered for them so that we wouldn't be getting Jersey bull calves, which are relatively low value. We'd hopefully be getting Jersey heifers, but I mean they're quite expensive, you know. It's €50 a straw in comparison to, if you just want a normal conventional straw, it's maybe €12, and then you have to pay the AI man, artificial insemination man, his fee as well, or woman, their fee. Look how cheeky they are. So yeah, it's not cheap, you know. And then of course you have a slightly lower conception rate with sex semen as well. So,
oh, do you?
Yeah, you do.
I didn't know that. I didn't realise that actually.
So it's.
But you know, with the Jerseys, you need a Jersey calf.
Yeah.
Really.
Ideally, a Jersey heifer.
Jersey heifer calf. Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of people do this thing called synchronization, where they can inject the heifers with hormones so they come in heat all together at the same time and get them in sync.
Yes.
And that helps them time the AI, because you have to be quite specific, especially with sex semen, because of that lower conception rate as well. You really want to be timing it just right. But we can't do that because we're organic, so you can't... can't inject them with hormones.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it's just you and me watching them. Yeah. Very old-fashioned.
And how long are they in heat for?
A very short period of time. Relatively short period.
Is it?
Yeah.
A day.
Basically, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's an AN-PM rule. There's all kind of exact rules around it that you have to adhere to.
Because I always thought, you know, say if they were in heat in the morning, that to have them inseminated in the afternoon was better.
Yeah, that's the AM-PM rule. Yeah. Right. Oh, we let them out?
Yes.
Okay.
Right, that's the ladies out. You make a run for it. Oh my God, where did that shower come from?
Oh. Well, the only thing is it's mild, so there'll be grass growing after this, Anna.
About time for it. Yeah. About time for it. Yeah. Look at them, heels kicking in the air, and they're happy as Larry.
Remember last year when they were in the field, they come up to us and they were very friendly and very quiet. So hopefully they'll settle down after a week or two.
Yes, but I have granny power on my side. And speaking of that, you have something in your hand. There's something else that you're going to be doing today because it is the 1st of May.
1st of May, yes. And so we shake the holy water on the animals, on the fields.
Are things that desperate?
I know.
Are you that worried about me?
But people always did it anyway in the old days. So I still keep up the tradition. I've got plenty of knock water that you brought back on your trip to the shrine there in Knock. And
being misrepresenting me there, I think it was a stop off. It wasn't quite a pilgrimage to one spot.
Well, you brought back the holy water so that was good. That was good and useful to have.
So where are you going to spread it? Where are you going to shake it around?
Well, traditionally, my mother anyway, she would go north-south. So north, south, east, west. And then some for ourselves as well, don't forget. So.
And was it always done? Was it always a tradition? I mean, is it Catholic though, or is it pagan, or what is it?
Well, it's Catholic and pagan, I'd say. Do you know, it's definitely Catholic, and it was a big thing in school.
There is that Celtic tradition, and even locally we have a place in Limerick called Knock Aney, but actually it's Cnoc Onia, and the Hill of Onia, and Onia was a Celtic goddess of fire, and fires are actually still lit around Knock Aney this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember that, and there's a hill the Hill of Dirk in Pellascreen, where my father came from, and we could see the fire lighting in the distance, even though we were about 50 miles or more away from. Yes, because it's almost in Tipperary, yeah. But we could see it quite clearly from our house.
Well, whether you're invoking paganism or Catholicism, go on, shake that holy water, see if we get some baby calves next year.
Yeah, okay. North, south, east, west, everything is blessed. The calves, the wind carries it. That was the idea of you know, that if you weren't next to the animals and things like that, it was carried in the air. So give a little bit to the neighbours as well.
I don't know, Catherine. Are the fields not wet enough without going and adding holy water into the mix as well? Would you like something to do? This leads me on to our next item very nicely, discussion of water. Would you like something to do this long weekend that is A, free, B, will keep little people occupied, C, will get you out in the fresh air, and D, will give you that slightly satisfied feeling of doing your bit? Of course, that's exactly what you want. So let me suggest getting involved in the Big River Watch, a citizen science project being run this weekend all over Ireland and Britain to record and identify what kind of conditions our rivers are in. Emma Brisdian from the Rivers Trust is one of the coordinators. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Philip.
Not the first Big River Watch. Of what value has this exercise proven to be in the past, Emma?
No, this is the second one. So we run two a year, and the one that we run last year really helped us find like pollution hotspots and things like that. So we've got a network of amazing local trusts that all look after sort of a catchment or two or a region. And by using all of the power of citizen science and the public, we're able to get a really big data set and have a look over a really large scale over our landscapes and see how our rivers are doing. And one of the things we can do is say, OK, this area perhaps needs a little bit more work than somewhere else, and we can identify problems. The more we know about the problems, the better we can try and solve them and support our rivers.
How big a data set? How many people got involved?
Last year we had around 5,000 people, so that was our first one ever, and we're hoping to make a bit more of a splash, get an even bigger data set and get more people involved, especially if the weather is looking good this bank holiday, we're hopeful.
What are you asking people to do then?
It's super simple. All you need to do is download the free Big River Watch app. Just search that on your app stores. And then you just spend 15 minutes near your local river or go and explore a new one. And you fill out a very short survey in the app. So you tell us about what you can see. You don't need any experience or any special equipment. Just tell us what wildlife you see, what pollution you see, how you feel, what the water looks like, things like that. It might not seem like much, but it's really valuable data.
Should I go to somewhere that I know is in trouble, that I know there will be pollution there, or should I just pick any stretch of river at random?
You can pick any stretch of river at random, but certainly if you know there's a problem, this is a great way to make sure that it is recorded in a large data set.
I think one of the interesting things you're doing here is asking people how the river makes them feel. You're going to get some interesting data back there on the social and the psychological value of rivers.
Oh, we are. I mean, we know generally that spending time in nature is brilliant for our well-being, but looking at the data already that's coming through, it's really fascinating to see how people are connecting with their local spaces and how whether they think that their river looks healthy or unhealthy is changing the way that they feel when they're spending time next to them as well. It's really underscoring that connection that we have with our blue spaces.
Excellent stuff. There are Apple and Android versions of this app. Big River Watch. I downloaded it the other day. It really could not be simpler. A great thing to get involved with. Emma Brisdian of Rivers Trust, thank you very much. When they pulled the door behind them at the close of business today, Gerard Mollia and his wife Anne will mark the end of a family business that first opened in 1938 by Porrick, Stefan and Sean O'Mollia. Famous for their knitwear and the loyalty of customers in the city of Galway and beyond, Lorna Siggins discovered the shop full of well-wishers when she called into them earlier on in the week. Anne explained how pleased they were to see so many familiar faces.
It's been a wonderful experience meeting all of our old friends and hearing lovely remarks.
This is Anne Banniwalia in their shop surrounded by the last of the tweed, arans, woolen socks and hats.
And people go back to the 1930s, 1938. Women remember when they brought in socks to Porrick O'Mollia during the war years.
It was a cold winter during the emergency when the family started providing a commercial link between local craft knitters and the wider world.
The story was that they hadn't sold anything on a bad winter's day. And yes, and they came down to Dominic Street and he said it was terrible to think that they stood in the rain and in the bad weather. And he said they didn't need to do that anymore, that he'd buy from them, and in fact he would supply them with the wool. It was amazing what women did, in addition to rearing large families, doing a bit of work on the land, minding hens and ducks and turkeys and all of those things, and trying to sell some of those at Christmas. Women had to do everything to bring in money, enough money, to keep big families together. The socks were a great cash product because the women would have the yarn and they'd knit maybe 10 or 12 pairs. And they taught their daughters at a very early age. I have an knitter still working for me who learned how to make socks when they were 6 years old. Now, what they would probably have done is they would probably have knitted from the top down. So they'd knitted as far as the heel. Mother would do the heel and the toe. Turn the heel and graft the toe. But they would do the rest of the work. And that would be a big help to her so she could have more work done. But those same girls told me that when they were 12, they started to knit the sweaters. Now, again, I imagine there would have been a lot of starting the rib for the cuffs and the body of the sweater. But I actually know knitters who learned how to do the most intricate sweaters at the age of 12.
What you're showing me here.
And the remarkable thing about this is there was no paper pattern.
This, or the yarn.
No, and this has never been written down, that particular stitch. The path from the cliff top to the shore.
Anne recalls the moment when tweeds and woolens went global.
One of the great breakthroughs was when the film The Quiet Man was made. That was 1951, May 1951. And the weather was marvellous. So Lord Killannon brought John Ford to visit, and that's when clothing was made for John Wayne, for Barry Fitzgerald, for John Ford's brother Francis, and Ger's aunt, Auntie Sis, made the clothes for Maureen O'Hara. Ger's mother always told me that she stayed up 3 days, 3 nights, making outfits for the race day scene in Letargesh Beach. Skirts, shawls, she did all of that.
Where were you?
Did you run away?
No, I let you ask it. You were...
Oh, you were, Jerry's very shy.
Do
you want to show me around the shop, chair?
Yeah, whatever's left of it.
Yeah.
Hello, how are you?
This is a picture, this black and white picture now above the counter, that's the Quiet Man cast.
The challenges, too, are now global.
They're importing from China. Good luck to them, if that's what they want to do. But our ethos, our philosophy always was to support the best of Irish craft, which we've done. And we've always supported them from all over the country, from the top of Donegal to the tip of Kerry.
And then this picture here.
Yeah, that's Siobhan O'Malley, my uncle.
Gosh, he looks great there, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Tweed trousers.
Yeah, and the Bonine jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the iron sweater.
And then the hat. I knew the person who made the hat. A woman from Moycullen, her name was Mrs. Keady. And she made your beautiful iron sweater.
Mm.
The one, when I met her, he was wearing this incredible iron sweater.
And when you first met him?
Yeah. And so the following Christmas, he asked Mrs. Keady to make one for me, which I still have. And
so she fell in love with your iron sweater. And do you still have the sweater, Cher?
No.
But I have mine.
Okay, all right.
I have mine.
It's a long time ago.
And would you wear an iron sweater?
No.
Too warm. Jer's mother, whose name was Bridie, she was a gifted knitter, and she began to recruit knitters in the 50s when there was demand for the iron sweater. When the Clancy brothers went to Carnegie Hall and their mother had the lovely sweaters made in County Tipperary, and they performed with all of the lighting and all of the heat in that concert, the Aaron sweater really took off. And that was also when travel from the United States took off. People were flying to Ireland. They would have been ordering tweed jackets for men from McGee's, and in fact would sell up to 1,000 every season. 1,000 tweed jackets for men. And they had beautiful bolts of fabric they could offer to people, you know.
Oh, all the money that e'er I spend, yeah. I spend it in good company.
But we have had good few people coming through. The nicest guy I met donkeys years ago, Paul Newman. We made hats for him, actually, tweed hats. An extremely nice man, piercing blue eyes, a really good-looking man. The other one I used to enjoy was Garrick de Bruin. He always came in and he always bought a bolt of tweed. He had his own tailors in Dublin, you know. But he was always with the poet and diplomat Richard Ryan. Of course, they'd always be coming from Mourns of the Weir, you know, so they were... But they were good fun.
So you could have sold them the shop.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Parting glass.
Well, will you send it straight away?
Good night, Joy.
If you're going to have a man crush, I suppose Paul Newman is as good a man crush as any to have. Big River Watch is the name of the app that you need to download. Take you 30 seconds to do that. On the Countrywide Big River Watch team this morning, Amandine Passo-Devine had a hole in her wellies. Ruth Kennington skipped stones. Eileen Heron told everyone to get out of the water and into the car. Sinead Mooney is on the way with playback after the news. Enjoy your long weekend, folks.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.